I'm Macy Chen.
And I'm David Ball.
You're listening to CFRO, The Pulse, here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
We are your independent daily news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
And we're streaming at thepulse.coopradio.org.
Good morning. It is Monday, December the 28th. And on The Pulse today, we're looking back over our year at some of our most memorable interviews and broadcasts. We hope you've had a good holiday season. On today's show, we're looking back at history-making events of the summer, the massive uprising and movement for Black Lives Matter. We'll look back today on some of the interviews we did with leaders in the Black community in Vancouver, including the Hogan's Alley Society, Black Lives Matter Vancouver, and others, about this city's vibrant and rich celebration of history, Black culture, and activism. First of all, here's an interview that we did with three people who are active community organizers in Vancouver's Black community. They are Udokem Irigbu, who is with Black Lives Matter Vancouver, as well as the Stratagem Virtual Conference. Angela Marie McDougall is Executive Director of the Battered Women's Support Services. She's also involved in Feminist Deliver, which is planning an event for next week on anti-Black racism. And Lamu Mugabo is with the Hogan's Alley Society. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the phone, Udokem, Angela, and Lama. Thank you so much.
Thanks, David.
Thanks for having me, David.
I wanted to start just talking about, first of all, what we're watching when we see the news or look at social media, kind of unavoidable right now. How are people feeling? It's a heavy week.
I guess I'm feeling a bit confused, angry, but also fired up. I think this is the time has come for big changes.
Yes, I have to agree with Lama. I'm feeling very angry, but surprisingly also hopeful. I think it's normal for folks to understand that Black people around the world right now feel exhausted. And not just because of what's going on and the levels of exhaustion that brings, but also personally, I haven't had a moment to really process or grieve what's happening because there's still a lot of labor being demanded of me. And for a lot of Black people that are out there protesting, that's still labor that they're putting out there. And I feel like that level of exhaustion is one that's incalculable.
Yeah, there's, if we're talking about, the United States and Canada, to be a Black person in these lands is to, truly recognize that these lands are stolen lands, that we are a product of colonization and capitalism in the ways in which our relationship to these lands, wherever we come from, and the degrees of separation from Africa for all of us here, there, this is trauma. This is an ongoing trauma that is felt on a day-to-day basis in all of the daily interactions that we have and that we experience walking through the world as Black people, and that's certainly my experience as a Black person, and it's ongoing trauma. And what is interesting in right now is, and I think that the function of the pandemic has been to facilitate this, that we people have a bit more time on their hands perhaps to reflect. And I mean people, I'm not talking about Black people right now or Indigenous people. I'm talking about the rest of the societies on both sides of the border to reflect on mm-hmm. police violence, about Black death at the hands of police, about historical and current subjugation that is baked in to the making of the United States and Canada, and there's unique things and there. So on a day-to-day basis, right now, a feeling of wanting to manage my energies. This is a lifetime. This isn't about this moment. This is about a lifetime that has gone on prior to today. I'll need to continue onward. And I do prefer to be in a feeling of action and taking action. I don't know if this is going to be hopeful I don't know if we can expect that the state, the Canadian state, the U.S. state is going to change in a measurable way. I don't know if we're going to, you know, go back to a status quo right now. But that is also the function of the pandemic. We're not sure what the future holds. But this is an opportunity to move. And that makes me feel energized. And that's where I want to be, in a state of energy.
Yes.
I've been reflecting on what has happened in the last week or so. And to me, the question that comes to my mind is, do we live in a colorblind society, or do we live in a society that's blind to racism? When someone is handcuffed, laying down on the ground, a police officer presses his knee on a person's neck, and the person says, "I can't breathe," you assume that because they can't talk, they can breathe, but that's not true. And that's, so I think in our moment, what we witness is that that police officer has lost humanity, and he has no right to claim that his job is there to protect and serve. And I think that for most people, when we talk about Black Lives Matter, and I've heard people challenge me, they say, "What do you mean Black Lives Matter? You mean white lives doesn't matter?" They're missing the point. And for me, I think this is all a reflection of white supremacy at work. And I think that for the ordinary white person who hears us talk about or complain about racism every day, they don't see it. And so I'm hoping that what has happened in Minnesota will bring change that we've all been waiting for. When you see the burning and you see all these cities rise, I'm hoping that something good will come out of this. And we also know that after the fire, a new life comes in. So I'm really hopeful that when we talk about allies, that whites have to rise. Those we consider to be our allies have to rise to the occasion, because if we agree that white supremacy has to go, it cannot be dismantled by Black people. White people created it, and they have to do it. We can help, but they have the agency to do it. So I'm really hoping that, you know, good things are around the corner. I can only hope for that.
I was wondering, Angela, you mentioned kind of the protecting yourself right now and the exhaustion and kind of this mix of complicated feelings. How do you manage that? How do you balance the things? What is it about this moment that kind of makes it so so tenuous, I guess, to be feeling and watching and observing?
So, I mean, as a black person in here in Canada, the relationship of social subordination and subjugation in dealing with the Canadian state has been my lived reality for all of my life. Me as an individual here in Vancouver, that was one city within the Turtle Island that was successful in eliminating Black people, a Black neighborhood, to just dismantle mm-hmm. our community, and to and my parents met in this community, Hogan's Alley, and which was mm-hmm. was a Black community that thrived. So it thrived, and Canada as a state Canada as a nation state has taken great effort to prevent Black people from being here. From the 1800s until present day, the immigration policy was to bar immigrants to Canada who were deemed from races that were deemed undesirable, and Black people were identified as being undesirable. So my humanity, how the Canadian state has wanted to view me as a human, and to relate to me in a human way, that hasn't happened. That has not happened, not in state, not in the state practices, nor in the day-to-day interactions that I have, you know, just navigating my life. So it is, you know, today is just another opportunity to point out this fact that it is, it has been irrelevant whether the it's been relevant, you know, the sense, and you know, and I would have to say, like, from the prairies out here and the other side of the you know, the Rockies, mm-hmm. the fact that there has been Canadian policies, immigration policies, municipal planning, urban planning policies that proactively prohibited people like me that come from Africa originally, with melanin, the melanin in our skin, denied mm-hmm. our humanity and eliminated our presence in this place, is at the heart of why that is a violence that that we cannot begin to measure, and it plays out in the day-to-day interactions, both with the state but also with our, you know, our fellow quote unquote Canadians. Who are unwilling to recognize, unable, and I'd say unwilling to acknowledge and recognize, while you know, our own Canadians, Canada's own white supremacist underpinnings, mm-hmm. And in some ways, United States gives Canada cover because United States is so egregious in the overt. And where Canada's been more covert, but let me tell you, proactive. It's covert, but it is mm-hmm. proactive. So those are facts.
Proactive racism, you mean?
Well, I mean, proactive. Yeah. I just talked about the immigration yeah. policies.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You know, eliminating our existence in this country. We were deemed undesirable. And then when we were able to be in the country here, it was under very specific temporary labor arrangements. And where we did exist in any kind of major way, such as in Nova Scotia, Mi'kmaqi territory, or in Toronto, Corano, we've been subjugated and cordoned off into neighborhoods that then mm-hmm, were mm-hmm. blighted,
mm-hmm. Yes.
and troubled, you know, problematized and over policed and under protected. So that's Canada's history and current context for this conversation today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I 100% agree with that, Angela. I feel like the uprising that we are experiencing right now, it's very much directed at the U.S. And yes, on May 25th, things kind of took a turn and people said enough is enough for the umpteenth time. However, Canada needs to sit back and like evaluate its own history and it's like what's actually happening right now for Black and Indigenous people on these lands. I need to see an uprising in Canada around Canadian issues as well. Why Canadians are so quick to point the finger at the U.S. when things like this are happening right yeah. in our backyard. In Surrey, a 17-year-old girl unarmed was handcuffed by police at a bus stop waiting for the bus. In Toronto, we know about Regis Korchinki Parquet, whose family called the police for a mental health situation and their kid ended up dead. And so these are things that are happening. They're urgent and they're dangerous for folks in the Black community. And we need Canadians to step up for things happening in Canada as well, not just things in the States. And for when they have an excuse to point a finger, the Indigenous and Black communities here are in danger and they're under constant attack by state violence. And it's unacceptable.
You are listening to The Pulse on CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM, and online at thepulse.coopradio.org. I'm David Ball. I was just thinking about the Montreal incident where the police killed a teenager playing dice a few years ago. And just it still sticks with me, you know, that we are not, obviously not immune. But the thing is, everyone has been saying this. It's not like Black people have not been speaking out about this for decades. We've all had a chance to hear it. Any thought about what? Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think it's true too that we talk about, you know, the impact of racism. We talk about anti-Black racism, But I think it's difficult for people who don't have black friends, who don't know black people, to really feel our pain. And so we love to compare ourselves with Americans, and we point the finger to how overt they are, how egregious racist they are. But I think when we point the finger, remember, three fingers are pointing back at you. So Canada has to really look in the mirror and see this as an opportunity to make changes and long-lasting changes. I think that it's really critical to understand also that what we saw in Minneapolis is because someone had a camera and filmed it. There's so many other things that happened, so many deaths, so many atrocities that happen to black people, but if you don't see it, you don't believe it. And so I hope that, again, that this will lead us to new changes in terms of policy and in terms of actually valuing life and bringing humanity to policy.
Udo Kam, you mentioned at the start the sort of sense of hopefulness looking at the uprising. What has been most inspiring for you and other members in your friend circle that you've seen so far on both sides of the border?
The most inspiring is friends that have never spoken up are now speaking up. And I think that that's mm-hmm. where I draw my hope from. And they're acknowledging their complicity in the fact that they've never spoken up before. Friends are now having conversations with their parents, their grandparents. Mm-hmm. They're now making it a part of their lifestyle. It's no longer a choice. It's not something that you pick up and mm-hmm. drop off. Like, I don't get that choice. And so my friends are very clear about that now. And my community is clear about that, that if you care about me and other black people in your life, and if you care about humanity in general, you understand that a lot of us don't have that option. I don't decide when to pick up and drop off an issue that affects my life. And so in solidarity, you should do the same. And I have found them to actually, lots of action happening, lots of people are putting their money where their mouth is. A lot of youth are standing up. But I'm hoping that it's sustainable. I'm hoping that it's not just something that we've seen before, you know, an uprising, it gets really hot and then it fizzles right out. And so I'm hoping that we're able to carry this forward into the future, and that we can actually make small changes in our community, in our place of work, at home, and in policy and in government, and make these changes so that we never, ever have to march again. Because I would really never want to march again because another life was lost so unjustly.
Mm. Yeah, well said.
I think for me, what's encouraging is to see voices of non-blacks who are speaking out. And also, I saw a sign that said, "White silence is white violence. So you have to use your whiteness to speak up against injustice. And as much as we want money, and we're grateful that Hogan Zale Society has been getting a lot of positive feedback and people are offering money, but I think beyond money, we need systemic change. We need structural change in terms of police. We need to find a way of defunding the police so that we can invest money into community-based organizations that are working on the ground to fight poverty, because poverty is at the base of all this madness. And until we've galvanized to end poverty, to fight systemic racism, it will come back again.
Yes, I support that as well. We do need to have more conversations around defunding the police and rerouting those funds to actually support and uplift the community. The police is very clear, and we've been saying this time and time again, that they do not protect us. And so we need to reroute those funds, especially in a city like Vancouver. And we're talking about a budgetary shortfall of $150 million, but then the police gets over $300 million of what's in the budget. We know where to get that money from. That's from the police's pocket, and that needs to happen.
We're coming near the end of our conversation. I wish we could keep going, but I guess I wanted to maybe ask each of you to kind of close by sort of reflecting on the power of Black community organizing and Black conversations happening, and why that's why that is so important and what that means to you.
So one of the things I also noticed in what was happening in the States is that Black protesters come out and they try to protest. And then there's people who come and agitate. So I think, with all due respect, when Blacks organize, non-Blacks should follow. They should follow the leadership of Black people, not try to take over. And I think it's really important for those of us who are listening to us, that when you come to support, don't take over the organizing. Listen to the leaders, the community leaders who are doing this work. Otherwise, it's going to come back again to haunt us. So definitely, we need alliance, but we also need to respect Black leadership and listen and follow.
Well, I go from some thinking of and it's been very important for me to these words from Angela Davis, with the idea of freedom is a constant struggle. I cannot, I've been around long enough and organizing long enough, for the liberation of us from a intersectional and decolonial point of view, to know that the roots are deep here, and the roots of the problem are very deep. And most of the time, we sit on the surface in moving around the deck chairs, if you will, on the Titanic, in a sense. And so the roots are the problem, and so we it's important to do the work on the top for sure. And addressing the roots is a bit more of a struggle, in a sense, because the roots are very resistant to change, because the states have been made. Canadian state, United States have been formed. The very making of these nation states as nations have been formed in a very particular way that was to ensure my subjugation and my disenfranchisement. And so there's a number of different layers here to sort through, I'm watching how we move along the surface. And I know that change does not come easy, and that it doesn't. These states do not change because they want to. They end up having to cede to public opinion, and that is, that's where we're at right now. In continuing to move forward, but freedom is a constant struggle, and I expect to resist every single day. The way that the individual community and systemic institutional and systemic and cultural framings want to continue to subjugate me, I resist every day, and obviously within communities that are in resistance as well.
Udo Ken, did you have any closing thoughts about this? Closing thoughts on just why community organizing in the Black community is so important and essential to this resistance and liberation?
Yes, I think that for nothing else, it brings together people of like that have the same struggle, and I feel like there's so much power in you and people walking together that have the same goal in mind, and similar shoes. And I feel that community organizing within the Black community, especially here in Vancouver, is one that is so intimate and one that is connected to to the people that have been in Vancouver, that are from Vancouver, people that have been organizing before myself or before Black Lives Matter came to Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really important to tie those connections together. We all don't have to be one big body, like one, you know, Black Lives Matter collective. We can all have different different visions and different mission statements and stuff, but we have the same end goal. Like, we align in the same purpose. And I feel like it's really fundamental that we have more community organizing targeting different areas that need that where white supremacy is very prevalent and it needs to be dismantled, so that it's like basically one giant iceberg and we have to chip at it from different areas to actually make a difference. And it's slow. It takes a very long time, but it works. It really does work.
Hmm. That's all my questions. You mentioned the power of voices walking together, and all three of you have shared such powerful words and voices for many, many years. And I wanted to give you thanks for that. And to thank you for taking the time and willingness to speak.
Thank you for inviting
me. Yeah, thank you for having me, David. Thank you so much.
Thanks for this opportunity, and I'm glad to be here with you, Dokum, and with Lama.
We just heard Udokem Irigbu with Black Lives Matter Vancouver, as well as Stratagem Virtual Conference. Angela Marie McDougall is Executive Director of the Battered Women's Support Services. She's also involved in Feminist Deliver, which is planning an event for next week on anti-Black racism. And Lamu Mugabo is with the Hogan's Alley Society. And that's our Year in Review show for today on January the 28th. This show originally aired on June the 3rd, 2020. Thank you so much for listening, and happy holidays.
And that's our program for CFRO, The Pulse.
Your independent news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
Every weekday, 7 a.m., here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Find our previous podcasts and interviews at thepulse.coopradio.org.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.